You are listening to Word of Mouth News on CKLN 88.1 FM, broadcasted right here out of Ryerson University in Toronto. Today is Friday, December 17th, 2010. I'm Craig Fortier. I'm joined in the studio today by my regular co-hosts Ryan Hayes and Yogi Acharya. Today's show is hosted here by Known as Illegal Radio, where we will be discussing the growing campaign in defense of human smuggling with Karine Baki, a lawyer at the South Asian Legal Clinic of Ontario. In the second half of the show, we'll join members of OCAP Radio for a special report from some of the front lines of struggles in North America against global austerity and discuss the year of resistance 2010 as it comes to a close. But first, the news.
We begin in Georgia, where the largest prison strike in U.S. history has reached its eighth day. Thousands of those inside have united in a self-imposed lockdown to assert a variety of human rights. An end to slave labor, access to health care and education, communication with their families, and an end to cruel and unusual punishment. Despite a harsh crackdown, the strike has been raging on for the last week and shows no signs of ending. The strike has taken place from between 6 to 11 facilities across Georgia and is currently still strong in Hayes State Prison in Tryon, Telfair State Prison in Helena, Macon State Prison in Oglethorpe, and Smith State Prison in Glenville, Georgia. Correction officials refused to comment on the strike until earlier this week, when they confirmed these four facilities were on lockdown status. Although information is tightly controlled by the prison industry, inside sources claim that inmates have suffered a series of reprisal and punitive measures that include widespread destruction of their personal property, denial of food, and beatings. While outside temperatures have dropped to freezing, heat and hot water have also been cut in an attempt by prison officials to break up the strike. Advocate for prisoner human rights Elaine Brown has been in contact with the inmates and reports that inmates at Augusta State Prison were brutally ripped from their cells and beaten, resulting in broken ribs, one man beaten beyond recognition. She continued and said that officers assigned to the riot squad at Telfair State Prison had roughed up prisoners and destroyed all their property. At Macon and Hayes State Prisons, tactical squads have menaced the men for days, removing some to the hole, the wardens ordering heat and hot water turned off. Tear gas has been used to force men out of their cells at various prisons, while guards patrol grounds with assault rifles.
Meanwhile, in a special Toronto Media Co-op release, it is reported that police trainers appear to have told officers at last June's G20 summit in Toronto that special search and arrest powers extended far beyond the so-called 5-meter zone the public was led to believe existed. Officers were told the entire outer zone around the summit security fence and not just the 5-meter buffer would be subject to special treatment under Ontario's Public Works Protection Act. The public was told shortly before the G20 that officers had special powers, but only within a 5-meter buffer around the fence separating G20 leaders from the public. The 5-meter buffer was later revealed to be a sham. Police were also instructed to treat young people and heavy knapsacks as suspicious and told that medical emergencies and music were baiting tactics, the file reveals. The 71-page document consists of PowerPoint slides and accompanying notes from a training session for Waterloo, Ontario police assigned to the G20. In areas designated as public works, police were empowered to arrest anyone who did not provide identification and submit to being searched. Quote, "That is the suspension of civil liberties," said Leslie Wood, an activist and professor at York University who studied protest tactics. The training document also sheds light on police tactics in areas well away from the fence. Several independent reports have decried those tactics as heavy-handed, and they have led to $161 million in lawsuits and more than 280 complaints to official police watchdogs.
In Australia, hardline refugee policies were blamed this week for the deaths of at least 28 asylum seekers whose wooden boats smashed into jagged rocks off Christmas Island in the Indian Ocean. Residents of the rugged volcanic island and offshore Australian territory attempted to help by throwing life jackets and ropes into the boiling seas, but they were forced to watch horrified as the boat was dashed to pieces and its occupants were scooped up by massive waves and hurled against the limestone cliffs. By last night, 28 bodies had been recovered from waters so rough that volunteers standing on the 100-foot cliffs were soaked by ocean spray and had to dodge debris flying up from the vessel below. 41 asylum seekers were picked up by the Australian Navy, and one man made it to shore alone. It is thought that up to 100 people may have been on the boat, and with rescue efforts hampered by the mountainous seas and atrocious weather, it is feared that the death toll will rise as high as 50. Simon Prince, a dive boat operator who raised the alarm after being woken at 5:45 a.m. by screams for help, told The Independent that people were flying through the air and being crushed against the cliffs. There were dead bodies in the water, children. "I've got some very disturbing imagery stuck in my head," he said, "a little girl lying face down in the water." The rickety fishing boat, believed to have been carrying mainly Iranians and Iraqis, had sailed from Indonesia, a route plied by the majority of refugees heading for Australia. Christmas Island, 1,600 miles northwest of Perth, but only 220 miles from Indonesia, is the first land that such vessels encounter. It is also the site of Australia's largest immigration detention center. The Australian state's response was to quickly denounce, quote, "people smugglers." Refugee advocates, meanwhile, claimed the government's hostility to undocumented migrants had played a major part. Quote, "The fact that there isn't a welcome refugee policy makes it less likely that people on boats are willing to contact Australian authorities and to rendezvous safely," said Ian Rintel of the Refugee Action Coalition.
In related anti-immigrant news, Israel has mass-deported 150 Sudanese migrants who entered the country illegally in search of work. The migrants were flown out on Monday and were being returned to the Sudan via a third country, an Israeli official said, speaking anonymously. Israel recently stepped up efforts to stop Africans from entering illegally across its southern border with Egypt. The Israeli official said some 200 Sudanese had been flown out of the country in recent months after, quote, "agreeing to return home," end quote. But the latest operation was the largest yet carried out. Many of the migrants were concerned for their safety once they returned to the Sudan. The Israeli government estimates that over the past 5 years, more than 30,000 people of African descent have entered via the country's southern border in search of jobs and to escape the conditions of extreme poverty and violence in Sudan, Eritrea, and other countries. The government has been building a barrier along the Egyptian border to try to stop people from crossing it illegally, and it has also approved plans to set up a special facility to house those who are detained.
Bradley Manning, the 22-year-old U.S. Army private accused of leaking classified documents to WikiLeaks, has never been convicted of that crime, nor any other. Despite that, he has been detained at the U.S. Marine brig in Quantico, Virginia, for 5 months, and for 2 months before that in a military jail in Kuwait, under conditions that constitute cruel and inhumane treatment, and by standards of many nations, even torture. Interviews with several people directly familiar with the conditions of Manning's detention have established that the accused leaker is subjected to detention conditions likely to create long-term psychological injuries. From the beginning of his detention, Manning has been held in intensive solitary confinement for 23 out of 24 hours every day for 7 straight months and counting. He sits completely alone in his cell. Even inside his cell, his activities are heavily restricted. He's barred even from exercising and is under constant surveillance to enforce these restrictions. For the 1 hour per day he is freed from isolation, he's barred from accessing any news or current event programs.
The Algonquins of Barrier Lake took their demands to the Harper government and federal bureaucrats in Ottawa on Monday to reject the use of Section 74 of the Indian Act that makes it available for them to forcibly assimilate and destroy the country's traditional government, and to demand that the state respect the community's traditional government envisioned for environmental protection. Quote, "What if a foreign regime was destroying your system of government so it could then steal your resources and prevent you from environmentally protecting your homeland?" End quote, read a statement provided to the media. This is what the Harper government and federal bureaucrats are doing to the First Nations of Barrier Lake. For more than 2 decades, the Algonquins of Barrier Lake have been demonstrating environmental leadership to the rest of Canada, campaigning to stop destructive clear-cutting and to implement a sustainable development plan in their homeland in northwestern Quebec. But multinational forestry corporations and government bureaucrats have refused to honor any of the agreements signed with Barrier Lake. They have tried at every turn to undermine the small community, one of the poorest in the country, and prevent them from implementing and realizing their vision for the protection and stewardship of the forest. Led by Barrier Lake youth, the overwhelming majority of the community are struggling to preserve their traditional government so they continue to protecting the watersheds, forests, wildlife, and lands for all future generations. With these acts, the Algonquin of Barrier Lake, along with Indigenous sovereignty activists, have asserted that the Harper government is violating the Canadian Constitution, which protects the Aboriginal right to self-government, and they are violating the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, even though they have now endorsed it.
In Greece, Kostas Hatzidakis, who is now an opposition MP, was left with blood pouring from his head after being chased and beaten by dozens of protesters. He was confronted by up to 100 youths who shouted "thieves" and "shame on you" when he emerged from the Greek Parliament building on Constitution Square in central Athens. Protesters hurled lumps of concrete and paving stones at riot police, set fires to cars, and smashed shop fronts. The violence in Greece erupted during a general strike called by unions to protest against new labor laws, which unions say will give employers too much power and take workers' rights back to the Middle Ages. Greece is imposing the most severe austerity in the global north due to a 110 billion euro international bailout package for its financial institutions, which has brought with it the structural adjustment programs of the International Monetary Fund, backed by the force of the European Union. The 24-hour strike, the seventh this year, also grounded flights, closed factories, disrupted hospitals, and shut down trains, ferries, and buses across the country. An estimated 20,000 protesters marched on Parliament. A similar protest occurred in Greece's second-largest city, Thessaloniki, and Greece was saved from bankruptcy in May by an international rescue loan package. In return, the socialist government slashed pensions and salaries, raised taxes, and extended retirement ages. On Tuesday, the government won a key vote in Parliament on new labor reforms that include deeper pay cuts, salary caps, and a reduction of unions' collective bargaining power in the private sector.
A protest over low wages in Bangladesh garment industry has left at least 3 people dead and dozens of others injured in clashes with police in several major cities, including the capital, Dhaka. The government workers who make clothes for many popular Western brands were angered over a delay in the implementation of a government rise in wages due last month. The revised pay structure took effect in November, but workers say many factories have not yet implemented the measure, which has led to continuing protests in the recent months. The new wage of at least $45 a month represents an 80% increase on the existing minimum wage, as is the first since 2006. Reza Al Hassan, a police official, said tear gas and rubber bullets were fired into the crowd during the demonstrations after thousands of workers attacked factories and smashed vehicles at the Chittagong export processing zone on Sunday. In Dhaka, about 4,000 mainly female workers torched vehicles and blocked a main road in protest against employers, accusing them of not implementing the wage increases. Clashes were also reported in the city of Chittagong to Dhaka's southeast and Rupang in the northeast. 3 people have died, including a rickshaw driver who died on the spot after he was hit by a brick. In all, about 50 people have been injured at the zone where 20,000 workers attacked factories and a police station.
And that's it for our headlines today. We're going to go to a quick musical break. We have a track called Baghdad by Ahmed Habib, also known as Big Head, that we want to share with you. And right after that track, we're going to go to our feature interview with Kareen from the South Asian Legal Clinic of Ontario and talking about the statement in defense of human smuggling for free movement issued by No One Is Illegal earlier this week.
What's my relationship to God? Where was he when they killed Baghdad? City left to rot, perpetrators took pride in the act and no one was caught. Systematic theft of life, key to the murder plot. Canadian flags were used to choke me, trying to convince me that I forgot how my home looked before its soul was wrapped up in a knot and scribbled on dirty dinars dripping in blood mixed with oil drops. My brothers were filling graves and babies went missing from their cots and generations were sold to the nearest nation building shop where massacres would be carried out by the cops. And kids turned thugs tell you to stop and drop your name and which religion you chose to adopt, and wrong answers will mean that you're popped. Unless, of course, you died from the bombs that were dropped, or the 13 years of sanctions that killed 1.5 million in what was another forgotten Holocaust. And yes, Iraqis are being killed at their own cost, meaning that they are paying for everything from American Marines to a so-called government that is mourning when these baby killers are lost, or applauding soldiers lucky enough not to get shot, were smart enough to gain a lesson taught in that Fallujah resists till the last pop and what to, now they want a podium to stand on top and preach their regrets to the Iraqi people. That's like telling the indigenous that liberation is gonna come from the steeple, or that Palestinians will see no evil just as long as they forget about the destroyed villages under the feet of Tel Avivers and all these racist ways in which we perceive a people's rights, telling Iraqis when to fight and it's okay to write just as long as you don't ignite a gunfight in the middle of the night to take back what's rightfully mine. I need to see each line as a piece of shrapnel in the spine of those fighting this so-called divine battle where people are turned into cattle waiting to be slaughtered. As the days get hotter, coffins decorate our sons and daughters. We have two of the longest, sweetest rivers, but we're still searching for water. We all knew that Operation Iraqi Freedom meant death, and none of us mistook any of the promises as a new breath. Instead, we looked at it as an excuse for theft. And now look what's left. What's my option? Now that I've been sold in an auction where Canada won, we are hopefully lost in. Iraq will be back as women refuse to die, jumping back in your face from the graves in which they were tossed in. We must. We don't even have trust for neighbors that share the same wind gust. It is to Syria and Amman that our future is being bust. And Baghdad, how can you be gone? I dream of kissing you in the nights of Ramadan with the lighter on. Keep your hat tighter on. There's a military jet fighter on his way, and today he plans to take away the right to play and the right to sway and say what's on your mind. Like, hi, my name is Baghdad and I love Palestine. And thieves will meet with thugs in ways that are clandestine behind mosques and sing songs of how long they pretend to have struggled, not knowing all they bring is trouble and rubble and strengthen the bubble in which we live. Baghdad, who will you forgive? Will I be able to come back, stand and live with? I am ashamed. You are brave, standing in the face of thieves and soldiers using their rifles to rape, cripple, and maim. And all I can do is write poetry that's lame.